everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on producing good food when we come back. Well, close Bush family friends and often partner in crime Robert Bass is selling Gotham Helmsley, the office building that sits above Grand Central Station's terminal and the underground commuter train subway complex. Who are they selling it to? They're selling it to the United Arab Emirates, the same outfit, remember, that wanted to take over those six U.S. ports. This raises even more security concerns because over the past 3 years, Dubai has invested more than $1 billion in real estate here in the United States. Now, we mentioned this before, but it's important that you understand that Dubai has served as a depository for the Al-Qaeda wealth. Actually, Al-Qaeda wealth meaning actually CIA operating funds. Couriers with bars of gold and bundles of U.S. dollars were smuggled into Pakistan and then moved by the untraceable Hawala money transfer system to Dubai. And, when necessary, it is then distributed throughout the world. That is millions of dollars a day. And you should also remember BCCI. That BCCI, that defunct bank, which was founded by the Pakistanis and bankrolled by the United Arab Emirates. Well, BCCI collapsed. Billions were lost, and only one person ever went to jail, and he was a flunky. It was a money laundering operation for the CIA, the CIA's drug money, which was used to purchase weapons and for operational expenses. The scam was so widespread that many politicians in both the United States and in both parties were involved. George Herbert Walker Bush, George Bush Sr., covered up that scandal, if you'll remember. The bottom line here is this, and that is that the United Arab Emirates is an important part of the financing operation of the elitists. They now obviously have so much money that they are reinvesting that money in the United States. And you can bet that many of the elitists own part of that action with the Bush crime family in the forefront. And that is really what this is all about. It's an extension of money laundering. Now, the president of the New York Federal Reserve, Timothy Geithner, he said, quote, derivatives have not eliminated risk. We know less about how these markets will function in conditions of stress, and the most sophisticated tools available for measuring potential losses have less to offer than they will with the benefit of experience with adversity. Derivative trade problems are mammoth, and Geithner asserts that the total stock of unconfirmed trades is large, and until recently, it was growing considerably faster than the total volume of transactions. Now, this is incredible. If this were to occur in the stock or bond markets, those markets would simply stop functioning. Yes, what we're seeing in derivative trading is incredible. It's like all of the failures that we had in the late 1970s. That was in the billions of dollars. This time, we're talking about trillions of dollars. And the total stock of unconfirmed trades is large, and until recently, it was growing considerably faster than the total value of the transactions. Most trades are being assigned without the knowledge or consent of the original counterparties. All of these fail-to-deliver problems have to adversely affect brokerage house earnings. Now, Alberto Gonzalez, remember, he's the Attorney General. Well, he spoke recently before the law students at Georgetown Law School. And in his speech, he was justifying the illegal, unauthorized surveillance of U.S. citizens. Well, during the speech, the students rose and turned their backs to him. A following panel discussion ripped his argument to pieces. Now, the U.S. and United Kingdom forces in Iraq have detained and they have now interred more than 14,000 people, so says London's Guardian. About 4,000 of those have been detained for more than a year. 200 of those have been detained for 2 years or longer. The Iraq situation is on a par with Guantanamo, but on a much larger scale. The message herein is that the multinational force does not believe normal human rights standards apply, at least in this war, or to them. Most cases tell of torture, abuse, rape, electric shocks, and beatings with plastic cables. Doing these kinds of things is a recipe for disaster. And it tells us why the entire Muslim world is against us. It is so disgusting that it disgusts us also. Using many monitoring techniques, George Bush and the administration have launched a war against reporters who write stories that are unfavorable to the administration and their actions, and they're planning to prosecute these journalists to make examples of them in their war on terrorism. We also saw this very same program, which was put into operation by ex-President Nixon. If you'll remember, he used the Internal Revenue Service in his war against political enemies. George W. Bush has instructed Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez to use whatever means at his disposal to wiretap, follow, harass, and investigate journalists who have published stories about what is really going on and are a detriment to the war on terror. We have been victimized here at the International Forecaster for 4 years with no end in sight, and we expect their pursuit to increase in coming months and years. But we are a detriment to the war on terror. In their monitoring of phones and emails, they are gathering what they call evidence for prosecution. Now, the Patriot Act is part of what is being used to access private information on reporters. This is the first administration in our history to pursue the media in such a manner. In recent weeks, the FBI has issued hundreds of national security letters directing employers, banks, credit card companies, libraries, and other entities to turn over records on reporters. They did this to us more than 3 years ago. Under the USA Patriot Act, those who must turn over the records are also prohibited from revealing that they have done so to the subject of the federal probes. Fortunately for us, we had people from several sources tell us what the Gestapo was up to. Our president proudly announces that he has been breaking the law and will continue to break the law. George Bush and the current administration are simply street thugs, similar to Nazi brown shirts. These national security letters are starting to hit websites demanding traffic data, payment records, and they cannot access our websites and transmission technology because they reside in several other countries. This is for all of you who refuse to believe that you are now living in a police state. More than 8,000 members of the all-volunteer military have deserted since the Iraq war began. Of course, we have very low inflation, or so we're being told. New Englanders now face electric bill increases of 12% for the next 4 years, and undetermined increases after that. And under a plan to promote construction of power plants up in New England. Foreigners now own 27% of our mining industry. Foreigners own 24% of our information industry, 20% of our manufacturing industry, or what's left of it, 20% of professional, scientific, and technical services, 11% of our finance and insurance industries, and 45% of all U.S. government debt is now foreign-owned. The reason for concern here is that American-owned industry usually reinvests that money in America, whereas foreigners more often than not take their money home. Foreigners could end up owning more than 50% of our country. A gentleman farmer in Scituate Village, it's spelled S-C-I-T-U-A-T-E, Scituate Village, Rhode Island, sent a check to pay down his credit card bill. It was a check for $6,500. His check arrived at the card company, but it was not credited. He found out that the amount that they sent in was much larger than their normal payment. And if the increase hits a certain percentage, that is, a higher percentage, higher than the normal payment, then Homeland Security has to be notified, and the money doesn't move until the threat alert is lifted by Homeland Security. So remember, Fatherland Security has permission to spy on you. You are living in a police state. Remember, this is taken from the International Forecaster, the March 2006 edition, Volume 2. I might give you a plug here for the International Forecaster. It's written by, put out by, Robert Chapman. And you can go to their webpage. It's very simple. It's theinternationalforecaster.com. It's all one word. It's a long address, www.theinternationalforecaster, if you can spell that, .com, you win. All right, we've been talking about producing good food. Producing good food does not come accidentally. It comes very easily, but not accidentally. And the reason that we produce bad food in America is because we have bad agricultural practices. Our poor, if not bad, deplorable, or despicable agricultural practices are promoted by the food processing and the agricultural implements industries. After all, they're in business to make money. Now look at the process from the point of view of the Milk Producers Council. Milk is a highly perishable food. When I was a child growing up, they used to call it nature's perfect food. Milk, that is raw cow's milk, the way God designed it and intended for you to drink it, is so good that a calf in the first 90 days of its life exists exclusively on milk. That doesn't mean that they don't munch a little bit in their first 3 months of life on a couple of other things, but the calf lives exclusively on its mother's milk. Furthermore, the cow evolved a very, very interesting and ingenious methodology for health and nutrition for the calf. I never cease to be amazed at evolution and random chance. Listen to this. A cow has four teats that hang down from a bag called an udder. Up inside of the cow manufactures this product called milk. The milk has all of the nutrients that the cow has in her body. That milk contains iron and copper and manganese and potassium and vitamins and minerals and protein and carbohydrates and sugars and all the foods, all of the substances that are needed to nourish that calf. Isn't that amazing? Okay. Story gets better. There are sensors in those four teats that hang down from that udder. Those sensors are triggered by the calf's saliva as the calf nurses on the cow. The saliva in the calf's mouth, when it is deficient of any nutrient, not just a nutrient, not just one or two or three nutrients, but any nutrient, whatever the nutrient is, the saliva will communicate that to the sensors in the cow's teat, and that cow will immediately go out and eat. If it's available to her, she will eat whatever it is that that calf is deficient in its body, so that at the next milking, at the next nursing, she will have that nutrient in her milk for that calf. Like I said, you just can't beat evolution. Now, there's no design, there's no engineering, there's no premeditated forethought to that dynamic. It just happened by happenstance. It is just random chance over millions and billions and billions of years. But this leads us back to nutrition. If the cow knows what the calf needs and will go out and eat whatever it is that that calf needs in its diet, could it be then that the cow does that because she was designed to do that, because if she doesn't do that, the calf will develop a nutritional deficiency which will develop into a disease? And let me tell you from experience, that is exactly what happens. You see, we humans are greedy critters, and I'm no less greedy than anybody else. I learned years ago that there are calf formulas. Here, I can milk the cow and sell the milk to the creamery, and then replace that milk that the calf drinks from the cow with calf replacer. It's almost like human beings do. See, they go to the store and they buy infant formula, Infamil and things like that. Well, when you do that, you have what we call a bucket-fed or a bottle calf. And they're always sick. They're always undernourished runts. Just like human babies are always sick, undernourished runts when you raise them on a bottle. Now you take that same calf, I don't care, any calf, and you let that calf suck on the cow. Now that's what I do here. I have a cow, and she's about ready to come fresh. That means she's about ready to have a calf. And when she has that calf, she's going to start lactating and producing milk for that calf. Since she's a Jersey, and since she's been bred out for hundreds of years to produce more and more milk with higher and higher butterfat content, she is going to produce much more milk than that calf can consume. She's going to produce 2, 3, or 4 gallons of milk a day. And that calf can only consume about 1 gallon of milk a day. And if I don't milk that cow, she will develop mastitis, blue bag, and die. She's not very well equipped for the wild. Fortunately for her, she's living on a farm where she has me, a human, to take care of her. Isn't that just special? We humans take care of our cattle. Now, I'm going to milk that cow. I'm going to take the excess. And when that calf gets to be 5, 6, 7 months old, he's going to be one rambunctious, healthy, big, fat calf. Because he's going to have all the milk that he wants to drink. I'm just going to take the excess. Now, if I was a real greedy pig, I'd take all the milk and give him calf replacer. And I would raise a little, runty, undernourished runt, which I have raised many. And most dairymen raise undernourished runts because they want to sell the milk. Now, the reason that they're undernourished runts is because they don't get all of the nutrition that they need. They don't get enough protein. They don't get enough of the vitamins and minerals. They're getting vitamins and minerals, and they're getting protein. They just don't get as much. And that's why they're not as big. They're not as healthy. They're not as thrifty. Humans are the same way. Here's what you do. Deprive your diet of vitamin C. See how simple that is? Just don't eat any more vitamin C. Cut it out. You can call it just like an appendage, just a vestibule organ that's no longer needed. Did you have evolved beyond the need for vitamin C? In about 6 weeks' time, you will develop scurvy. You will be uncomfortable. You will be diseased. You will be ill at ease. You will not feel good. You will be sick. You will be symptomatic. Go to the doctor. He will perform tests. And over time, they will come back and they will say, "Oh my God, you've got scurvy." But he'll probably call it by some other name. And he will prescribe for you a drug. He will prescribe a prescription that costs a lot of money. And you'll take the prescription down to the druggist, and the druggist will fill the prescription, and you will take those pills, and your scurvy will go away. And what the doctor has prescribed for you is vitamin C, which you could have gotten from your tomatoes that you grew out here in your backyard, and never have gotten that scurvy to start with, because you would have been eating a normal, balanced diet had you been eating your tomatoes out of the backyard. You want to test it again? Let's give you some rickets. Let's take away, I think it's vitamin D. I could be wrong about that, but it's a vitamin-induced deficiency, and you will develop rickets. Go to the doctor. The doctor will perform many expensive tests, and when he gets through with those expensive tests, he'll give you the bill and a prescription. You take the prescription down to the druggist. He'll call this rickets by some other name, some other term. And then he won't prescribe this vitamin for you. Hell, you could buy that at the grocery store. He'll prescribe for you a drug put out by Pfizer or Merck or somebody. And you'll take that drug and your rickets will go away. And you'll be amazed. And you'll say, "My God, isn't modern medical science marvelous?" And you'll be happy, and you'll pay your money, and you'll just praise the doctor until your dying breath. It's a racket. It's a racket that's been going on for a long time. I wouldn't say that there's a conspiracy between the milk producers of America and the American Medical Association, but it's a symbiotic relationship. It works well together. And when you combine this with government and the Department of Agriculture, and with the United Nations and the Food and Agriculture Organization and so on, it begins to tell you a story. And the story is that as a matter of policy, we do not want farmers to produce good, healthy, healthful, nutritious crops and products. Because if they did that, there would be no more disease on planet Earth. And that's a despicable, that's an intolerable state of events. We can't have that. You know, if we didn't have disease on planet Earth, do you know what would happen? We would have instant depression. Here in America, 16% of our gross domestic product is in health care services. 16% of our economy would go right down the crapper. We can't tolerate that. Now, the pharmaceutical companies would be put out of business. We would lose pharmaceuticals. All of you investors that have stock in pharmaceutical companies would lose your money. Why we can't have that. And that's why there's this constant war on these vegetarians and hippies and other health food nuts and against health food stores and vitamins and minerals. And that's why the American Medical Association, in collaboration with the federal government, the Food and Drug Administration, are seeking to bring the regulation of vitamins and minerals under the medical authority so that if you want vitamin C, you have to get a prescription for it. You see, today you don't need that. Today, if you develop scurvy, you can go down and buy your own vitamin C. But in the future, when you develop scurvy, you'll have to go to the medical doctor who will give you expensive tests, who will then determine that you have a vitamin C deficiency, which he'll call by some other name, and then prescribe a drug called vitamin C, which you'll take down to the druggist and have filled for many, many dollars, and you will be deprived of that cheap source, that easy source of vitamin C. Now, of course, for those of us that eat right to start with, your health, your nutrition begins in the soil. And a fellow by the name of Lee, or Edward in this case, Edward Faulkner, discovered the cause of soil deficiencies back in the 1930s. Actually, his daddy had discovered it back in the 1880s. Faulkner, who went to ag school, came out and put it into practice and actually wrote a book. And in chapter 2, he asks the question, what is soil? What is this thing that we call soil? Before we get into that, let me give you a mid-course reminder, and then we won't be interrupted. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. Just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, these endorsements or recommendations that we give out do not necessarily mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed in total by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station, or the government, or the AMA, or anybody else. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, now I've been telling you that bad health is caused by bad food. Lee Faulkner, or Edward H. Faulkner, discovered and wrote a book called Plowman's Folly. If you want a copy of it, I think if you go to your used bookstore, tell them you want Plowman's Folly. The author is Edward H. Faulkner, spelled F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R. And you want to learn why it is that your soil is so poor. And you want to do something with your soil. I'm going to tell you a little story here. I followed the precepts here in this book. And I had a parking lot down here that was sterile below the house, parking lot. This is about 20 years ago. It was so sterile that we parked cars on it. About 10 inches down in underneath the soil, which is pure clay on top of the soil, just pure clay, and it had a rock ledge that not even trees could grow on, because once they grew down through that 8 or 10 inches of clay, they would hit the rock ledge and die. That's why we made a parking lot out of it. Then I read this book and I said, I'm going to try it. So I went out and got organic material and began surface incorporation into that 8 or 10 inches of soil, which is undergirded by this rock ledge, solid rock. I don't know how thick the rock is, but it's thick enough that trees can't grow through it. Now, over 20 years, that's my garden. I have 6 raised beds on that garden. The soil is all deep, black, rich, loamy soil filled with earthworms and all kinds of good nutrients. And that's where I can grow corn with 16% protein. For all you farmers out there that know that's impossible, I can do that. And I can do that because the soil's fertility is so high. Now, I can also farm that soil year after year after year, and I can withdraw all of that soil fertility and nutrition out of the soil and turn it back into a desert, which is what we're doing in North Africa and the Gobi Desert and in places all around the world, including Iowa, where in some places in Iowa, if you can believe this, desertification is beginning to set in. Isn't that just special? Well, that can be halted. It can be reversed. You can build soil out of desert. You can build soil out of clay. The world's first agricultural station was established in England about 100 years ago. Now, remember, this was 1943, so that was about 100 years ago, would be about 1840. At that time, its only aims were to learn why it was that England's soils would no longer grow as good a crops as formerly, and to discover remedies. Since this beginning, similar institutions have been set up in most of the other countries of the world. There are more than 50 experiment stations here in the United States. Some states support more than one, each independent, though all are under the same government. All but a few of these clinics have as a major objective the study of soil problems, and some of them have carried out soil experimental work which shows the effect of given treatments for as long as 50 to 75 years. Now, such an array of long-continued organized effort to determine the facts about the soil makes it seem very improbable that we should need to inquire at this late date as to what is soil. But yet, like electricity and a number of other very important and familiar things, the soil has never been adequately defined, nor is it expected that it's going to be defined in any recent times or any time in the future. It is hoped to arrive in this chapter at a more practical understanding of the soil than we have hitherto had. It certainly is true that if we could not manage electricity any better than we manage our soil, we could never enjoy the long periods of uninterrupted service that we do today. As it is, we do so completely know now how to manage electrical energy that it almost never disappoints us. The soil, by contrast, seldom ever comes up to our expectations, even though experts have been trying for generations to solve these problems of the soil. It should be remembered also that knowledge of electricity is a comparatively modern thing. Thomas Edison first made his lamp glow a little more than 50 years ago. Consider what has happened since. Electricity has become the ideal servant of man. It is the only one that obeys an order immediately, instantly, when the order is given. The merest touch of a button or the flip of a switch, and your servant is there on the dot. This satisfactory harnessing of electrical energy has been accomplished since the beginning of Edison's experiment. Now, when we compare this amazing progress with the almost complete lack of basic progress in agriculture, consider that hunger first emerged and then urged men to activity. We know that man began to cultivate his own food plants as soon as he wearied of the arduous travel and search for them where they grew wild. This happened necessarily quite early in our history. How early, nobody knows for sure, because history could not have been written by hungry men. And until a dependable agriculture had been established, hunger at times was inescapable. Soils had been cultivated, and then worn out, and then blown away long before historic times. And if we may judge by the tier on tier of buried cities in what now is total desert, the establishment of a city anywhere presupposes that there must have been an abundant food supply nearby. So when archaeologists stumble upon the buried ruins of cities built one on top of the other, we know that the local soils, at least at one time in the distant past, had to have supported a considerable population, or the city could not have been built and would never have existed. Now, you naturally would expect an art as old as agriculture and as fundamental to be developed to a very fine state of perfection by this time. At least, it would be expected to be far ahead of so recent an art as the use of electricity, wouldn't you think? And yet the history of agriculture has been a continuous series of disappointments and failures. No race of people has ever remained to solve the problems of the area that it had worn out and destroyed. Instead, as fast as the race had harvested the cream of fertility from one area, it sold the land or just left the land to its successors and then moved on to richer fields. The following quotation, written at the time of the California Gold Rush, is interesting in this connection. It says, some pains have been taken in this report to prove that 1,000 millions of dollars judiciously expended will hardly restore the 100 million acres of partially exhausted lands in the Union to that richness of mold and strength of fertility for permanent cropping which they possessed in their primitive state. Unquote. And let me pause and make a little comment here. When our founding fathers arrived here, a man riding on a horse through the prairies of Illinois would be hidden in the grass. You could not see a man riding a horse through the tall prairie grass. Now, that's how rich and abundant those soils were. Today, those soils are worn out and depleted. Grass grows about knee-high. Once in a while, it grows waist-high. If it's really good grass, it might grow chest-high. I have never seen grass as tall as 6 feet. Now, I'm told that there are some Sudan grasses around the world, that there are some various grasses that do grow that high. But they're not common. They're unusual. I told you a little earlier about a National Geographic article in which a man is standing in his garden. Standing on top of his shoulders is his wife. Reaching to the heavens is his wife with her hands outstretched over her head as high as she can raise them. And she is still about 6 inches short of touching the tassels on the top of the cornstalk. Now, that was in 1916. Now, boys and girls, something has happened in America. Indeed, something has happened worldwide to these virgin lands that we humans, when we farm them, when we bring agriculture to them, it destroys them. What is it that we're doing? Because when we leave those lands, which is what we used to do, it's called slash and burn. We used to do this in America. We slashed and burned. We went down to Alabama, and we took the forest land, we slashed it, and we burned it. And then we planted cotton and corn and tobacco. And in about 15 to 30 years, we would wear the land out. The insect pests would come in. The boll weevil would come in and destroy the cotton. And the corn borer would come in and destroy the corn. And the crops that we grew wore the land out. So we would abandon that land and then move over a mile. And we would slash and burn a new section of the forest. And then we would farm that land for 15 to 30 years. And then we would move on to another section and another section. What we discovered was the land that we abandoned in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, we could come back to 100 years later and we would have forest growing on it again. And we would have virgin land again and we could slash and burn it. And then we could farm it for another 15 to 30 years. Why is it that out here in the natural forest environment, the ground rejuvenates? When man leaves the land comes back to nutritive capacity. But when man comes onto the land, he destroys the nutritive capacity. What is it, boys and girls, that we're doing that destroys the fertility of the soil? Because everywhere we go, everywhere in the world where we have ever been, wherever the footprints of man are, we see soil fertility destroyed. Just take a look at the Sahara Desert, which was, 2,000 years ago, the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. Take a look at the Gobi Desert. These deserts, by the way, boys and girls, are growing at the rate of 100 square miles a year. That's 100 sections a year. That's an area the size of Rhode Island every decade. Now, this testifies eloquently to the fact that soil deterioration had made great progress in America nearly 100 years ago. Back in the 1840s, we could identify it. Many of our best-informed experts on soils would agree that, for all of our effort of the past generation, we have barely held our own. The average yield of most field crops for any decade that may be selected will not be very much larger than the average for the decade of 1870 to 1880. Now, we ought to have done better, surely. All right, let me pause right here. Now, this is why we want hybrid seeds. Because hybrid seeds, you can grow with chemical fertilizers on worn-out land and get higher yields. Now, wheat that would normally yield around 30 bushels to the acre, you can now get 60, 90, or 100 bushels to the acre using hybrid seed and chemical fertilizer and irrigation. And these inputs produce much more. Much more wheat that is nutritionally deficient. Wheat in the 1880s, which was 24% in Kansas, is now 7 to 13%. So what we find is, we can grow more wheat, but the wheat is nutritionally deficient. Now, the only purpose for eating food, boys and girls, is to put these chemicals, these nutrients, these minerals, these vitamins, these carbohydrates, these proteins into your body as fuel to fuel your body. If you get them in the right proportions, there's no sickness or disease. If you get them in bad proportions, then you get sickness and disease. Scurvy is a nutritional disease. All diseases are nutritionally induced. It's just that simple. Now, it happens that with rickets and scurvy, we know what the vitamin and the disease connection is. With cancer, we don't know. With heart disease and stroke, we know that atherosclerosis, we know that eating fat produces plugged up arteries, which produce heart attack and stroke. That's why they tell you, watch your cholesterol, watch your fat intake. At the very same time, our public policy tells us to go to McDonald's and eat 30% fat by law. Our legislatures prescribe by law the fat content of the hamburger that goes into that McDonald's Big Mac. You eat the Big Macs, they plug up your veins, then you have to go to the doctor who gives you a Roto-Rooter job called bypass surgery. It's good for the doctors and the surgeons, it's good for the medical profession, it's good for McDonald's. It's good for Swift and Armor Star who produce these food products. It's good for government, it's good for politics, it's good for taxes. It's bad for your health. And that's why it's so popular. Fat in the hamburger tastes good, but it's bad for you. It gives you a heart attack. Fat in the hamburger is good for the medical profession because it produces 16% of the gross domestic product. Heart attack and stroke are wonderful revenue generators for doctors and hospitals, for clinics and old folks' homes. It produces incomes for doctors who can buy boats and airplanes and big houses, which is good for the economy because it employs workers producing airplanes, big automobiles and boats and big homes for doctors with big incomes that they derive from fat, from McDonald's, Big Macs. I don't deny that. What I'm questioning is that really good for you? Is it good for me? I don't begrudge a heart specialist for making lots of money. I don't begrudge the medical industry charging what they charge. I'm not complaining about a lack of health insurance. I'm not complaining about medical costs. I don't use doctors. I don't use medical services. I don't buy health insurance. I don't want it. I don't need it. Don't use it. I don't eat fat. Conversely, I don't plow my fields either. And my soil nutrition is high. And the tomatoes and the peppers and the corn and the beans and the onions that I produce are just brimful of all of the vitamins and minerals that you can pack into them the way they were designed. And when I have a hunger for a tomato and I eat that tomato, I eat a tomato and that's about all I can handle. It's kind of like a banana. I mentioned that to you earlier. You see, you cannot overdose on good food. You can overdose on bad food, and that's why we have so many obese people. So if you're overweight, you're being starved to death. When you see some guy that's fat, the poor bastard's starving to death. He's suffering from nutritional deficiency. That's the bottom line. But you're not going to find government running around out here trying to cure that nutritional deficiency. Boys and girls, if we followed the scriptural principles of agronomy and we practiced the laws of God concerning health and agriculture, it would destroy our economy as we know it today. Nobody wants that. No Republican, no Democrat, no politician, no socialist, no communist, no Nazi, no fascist on planet Earth wants that. And you're not going to get it. Well, at least not publicly. Now, if you privately want good soils, good health, no disease, you personally can have that. But the nation cannot have it, does not have it, will not have it, and indeed it will not be tolerated. Now, that's just the state of affairs, so make up your minds to it. If you personally and individually want it, and you want good health, it's there. It's been there forever. It's been there since the Garden of Eden. It hasn't been there for billions and billions of years, boys and girls, because Earth hasn't been here for billions and billions of years. But it's been here for about 6,000 years, and for 6,000 years it's been available. And it's available today. Now, there's not very many of us, but there's a few. And I'm not looking for health insurance. And I would resist it if you offered it to me. And I wouldn't take it if you gave it to me. And I'm going to avoid it like AIDS, herpes, and VD. I don't want health insurance. Get the hell out of my life, George Bush and Republicans. And take your medical care and your national insurance and go to hell. Leave me out. But I'm not opposed to insurance. I mean, people who eat bad food are going to get sick. Sick people are going to suffer pain. People who are in pain need help. People who need help need medical help. Medical help is provided by doctors, nurses, hospitals, and the medical establishment who have drugs and potions and painkillers. And furthermore, I think that if you're going to eat bad food, you need health insurance. If you're going to eat McDonald's Big Macs and Jimmy Dean's Pure Pork Sausage, I honest to God believe you need health insurance because you're going to get sick and you're going to suffer pain and anguish and heartache and financial reversals. You need insurance. And after all, that's what insurance is all about. Now, the government and industry, and industries like food processing, and Swift, and Armor Star, and Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill, these people make money off of producing food. And when they produce a jar of mayonnaise, manufactured food, that's just filled with all kinds of cholesterol and fat and rancid oil, hydrogenated oils. I mean, those people make a lot of money. It employs people. Hell, you may be employed by one of these companies. The last thing you want is for these companies to go out of business. And that's exactly what's going to happen if too many of us produce our own food on good soils, because we don't need health insurance and we don't need doctors and hospitals. I mean, that's just the reality of it. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. It was Swinton who was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. Swinton absolutely outraged his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. You know it and I know it. And there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions. And if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with. And others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things. And any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions, you'd be put out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed one of my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. You know it and I know it. And what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We're the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We're the jumping jacks and they pull the strings. And we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We, said John Swinton, are intellectual prostitutes. Now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program and the New World Order. They're the men and families like the Windsors and the Rockefellers and the Bushes and the Bundys and the Carnegies and the Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that we ought to wise up. And we ought to start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and to survive this new world order and this global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about global 2000 Bible prophecy and this new world order, why don't you call and order my free 4-hour compact disc package. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. You can call right now and order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or you can call direct 417-273-4967. All right, next time we'll be back with more on Lee Faulkner and Plowman's Folly. Remember, you can probably get a copy of Plowman's Folly from a used bookstore. If you walk in, tell them I want Plowman's Folly. The guy's name is Faulkner, Edward Faulkner, F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R. They'll put it online, and they'll search around the world until they find you a copy. I think you'll be glad you did. Hey, we're just about out of time. Let me give you a final reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and Good night, friends.